Yes, so that you see the anti-Nazi League badges from 1977, and you see the idea of having a sort of grassroots movement, your single parents against the Nazis, post office workers against the Nazis. And they used to work very hard in particular parts of town where the National Front had got a lot of votes. At this time, it was only in a dozen towns around the country that they had significant levels of support. And so what they would do is they would go round from door to door, which is a tradition in British elections anyway, and they would have a campaign and say, oh, well, we'd like to explain to you who are the National Front. Look, here's what one of their members said about Hitler in a private meeting. Yeah, and look at it and try to sort of develop anti-Nazi ideas on a local level. There you see on the left, you see a pamphlet, which is the history of the Anti-Nazi League. The Anti-Nazi League, 1977 to 1981, by a gentleman called Dave Renton, so an activist. And you can see then that afterwards, the Anti-Nazi League was considered on the left as a great moment of British political history. Yeah, and you can see that they have a probably slightly hyperbolic title there, When We Touch the Sky, you know. So obviously he was very happy about his experience at this time. This is going when we touch the sky, and this is the arrow that they used, the history of the anti-Nazi League that's there. And this one here, this symbol here, skins against Nazis, was one example of the images and campaigns which were used at the time. I'm sure that you know that for complex reasons, skinhead music, and in particular Oi music, became attached to far-right ideas. And the Anti-Nazi League looked at this and they said, well, you know, here you have all these young working-class skinheads who like skinhead music. But really, the idea was it's possible to separate these people from racism, that racism is an accidental part of it and not a necessary part of it in a philosophical sense. And so instead of saying, we hate skinheads, they said, you know, well, let's have anti-Nazi skinheads, and there's a skinheads against Nazis, and there was a particular group called the Redskins, it was a rock group, which tried to say, you know, hey, you know, it's not necessary to be racist to be a skin. So a very, very much a popular propaganda campaign, very, very British in a way, it's very rare in Britain for campaigns to get signatures from intellectuals. It's true that in Britain, intellectuals do not have a lot of prestige. If you look through Libération, you have a university professor, lots of intellectuals write. In the British newspapers, nobody ever asks an intellectual to write because it doesn't have the same position in society. Yeah. And even if you think about, you know, the political history of France, you know, Sartre, Camus, etc., we don't have that in England. You know. Nobody really cares about intellectuals. And that's why I came to France. Not really. And there you get then a Rock Against Racism poster from the 1970s. And there are a few things you can notice about that. First of all, notice that this is a local concert. Not a big one, just a local concert with 300 people. 50 pence. And you can see that you have then the Tar Babies, the Vacants. Now the Tar Babies are no doubt reggae and the Vacants are punk. Plus a disco. This is the 1970s. That's what you had at the time. Well, a disco had like 40 people and 10 flashing lights. Yeah, it was a sad time we had to live through, I can tell you. Okay, so Rock Against Racism. Those are important moments in the 1970s. Then also quite new, the anti-racist movements of the 1940s and 1950s were small groups of black people trying to resist racism. And this was much wider. And black and white together, which was something new. They also occasionally did go for the big concerts, and this is the Anti-Nazi League Carnival. I think it's 1978. Steel Pulse, probably the most well-known British reggae group ever. And X-Ray Specs, a punk band, which I highly recommend. And the Tom Robinson Band, who is sort of rock and roll band, although they were considered at the time to be punk for rather complicated reasons. Tom Robinson Band, then the most political of the bands at the time. Carnival against the Nazis. This was sometimes used with very simple slogans. I remember seeing a leaflet that said, you know, the National Front don't like good music like reggae and punk, yeah? National Front, NF equals no fun. So very, very simple arguments. Now, some people said they were, some people were a little critical. So isn't that a bit populist? You know, NF equals no fun. The audience was 15-year-olds. And also, the audience was 15-year-olds from the 1970s when they were less sophisticated than today. My daughter's 15 and she's more sophisticated than me. So there we go. So here's our last set of dates for the history of multiculturalism, diversity, racism and anti-racism. I've just chosen a few dates. So the 1993, the racist murder of Stephen Lawrence, and 1999, the publication of the MacPherson Report. Well, we've been looking at that today, thank you to Marianne. And that led to, and now did it just lead to it, or was it going that way anyway? Hard to say. But in the year 2000, the Race Relations Amendment Act, that is to say an adaptation of the Race Relations Act, which really did change law. And I need to explain how it changed the law here. Traditionally, some of the ideas for the Race Relations Amendment Act apparently came from Canada or Australia, but I don't know a lot about that. But traditionally, there are two very well-known ways of trying to pass laws to change situations of discrimination. The first one is very simple, like the Race Relations Act of 1976. It's if you discriminate, it's illegal. Okay, so that's not very complicated, yeah? So if you have a shop or a company who are employing new people or selling people and they discriminate, this is illegal and you can take them to court and they have to pay money because they've broken the law. That's one. Now, obviously this is a tremendous step forward, but it has a little problem because you have to prove that they discriminated. And of course, this can be very, very difficult, yeah? You apply for a job and you have two black people and five white people, and all these seven people apply for 10 jobs and all the white people get a job and the black people, but how can you prove it's different? It's very, very difficult to prove discrimination. Also, you would need the victim to have, you know, enough money for a lawyer and so on. So it can be difficult to make this effective. And one of the another solution which has been proposed in different places is a policy of quotas. Now, perhaps you know that in the south of the United States, after the segregation era, they used, in certain areas to a certain limit, they used a system of quotas. So for example, they have had a university in the south of the United States, and they find we have 10,000 students and 9,000 are black. We have 500 professors, they are all white. And that was really the situation, absolutely extreme situation in the south of the United States. And so in this situation they said, well, maybe it's not a perfect solution, but from now on, 10% or 20% of all new professors must be black. So a very unsubtle approach, a very unsubtle approach, you know, 10%, 20%, whatever, but a law that says you must, and companies also were also in some cases obliged to say the percentage. So a very, you know, this quotas. Now, in Britain there have never been quotas. And there are no quotas, with the single exception that in some situations in Northern Ireland there have been quotas for Catholics. But in the United Kingdom, in connection with colour and ethnicity, there have never been quotas. Now, why not? You must remember that the percentage of black people in America is much higher than in Britain, much higher. Yeah. And secondly, of course, black people in America are not immigrants. And so that makes a big difference too. In any case, let's say quotas are always controversial. You know, quotas are always controversial. So for whatever reason, Britain had not taken this. And in 2000, Britain decided to use a third option, which apparently came from New Zealand and Canada. And this is the statutory duty to promote racial equality. Does anybody know what it is? Okay, I better explain it then, hadn't you? Let me give you an imaginary example of a hospital with 1,000 workers. and half of them are black. In London, that's not surprising. Yeah? You have a hospital with 1,000 workers, half of them are black in London, no surprise there. And in this hospital of 1,000 workers, there are 100 managers, and only two are black. This, again, is unfortunately not so surprising. And now, looking at this situation, after Macpherson, people say, well, the problem is not that we can prove that any individual was discriminated against, but there is institutional racism going on here. There is just habits of doing things in a way that black people are not becoming managers. And so the new law in 2000 said that every public body, hospital, university, local government, public body, not private companies, has a statutory duty to promote racial equality. Now, what does that mean? That means that this hospital must not only avoid illegally discriminating against individuals, they must show that they have a program to solve this problem. That is to say that they must study the situation. They say, okay, we have 1,000 workers, half of them are black, so really we want half of our managers to be black. So what can we do? But we're not using quotas. And so what they were obliged to do under the law is to have a project, a program of promoting racial equality. Let me give you some examples of what they do in this imaginary hospital. First of all, it's quite well known that if you have a committee, committees tend to recruit people who resemble them. Yeah, if you get a group of, people who love heavy metal, that they tend to recruit people who love heavy metal. And so one of the things they would do, typical thing to do in this imaginary hospital, they would say, okay, when we have a recruitment committee to recruit people next time, we have 10 people on a recruitment committee, half of them are white and half of them are black. All recruitment committees in our hospital will be half black and half white. He said, but we only have two black managers, we can't do it. Okay, we will ask somebody to come in for the day from a hospital in Manchester, somebody else to come in for the day from a hospital in Glasgow. Our committees will always be half black and half white to try to avoid this problem. Second example, every year in February, we will have a special training weekend for black workers who are interested in becoming managers. Special support, special information, special training. So that's just two examples, but there are many, many possibilities which allow the hospital to say to the government, look, here's what we're doing. We don't have equality, but we are promoting equality. And it has to be said that in general, the hospitals where the trade unions are strong, they are pushed by the trade unions. The trade unions encourage managers to go further. Also, the trade unions try to make this racial equality duty more widely applicable. For example, same hospital. Every year, our hospital buys 10,000 sheets, just textiles, yeah? We're the trade union. We want you to refuse to buy sheets except from factories who have a racial equality policy. That's very, very common, yeah? And say, okay, hospitals need to buy a lot of food. And the trade union say, we want you to buy food from companies who can show that they are trying to for racial equality. So this is a new kind of approach. Now, here's the bad news. This is 2000. I have not seen any detailed study to show if it works or not. I'm looking for one. I asked my friends. They don't have one. In fact, I may have to write it. It's not, of course, I mean, I think it's almost certain that it has some effect. But how much? I don't know. Research does not tell us that for the moment. Okay, so this is a big change. And this is 2000, so it's the year after the Macpherson report. There is an obvious link. That is to say that partly because of public opinion and partly because of a decision by the elite as to what will make British social life more productive and more stable, there has been this attempt to work for promoting racial equality. Notice the term in English. In France, I think it would be impossible even to write a proposal pour promouvoir l'égalité raciale. It's not the kind of term that you would use in France. It's a very different situation. Okay, there was something else I wanted to say about that. Oh yes, public opinion. It's not easy to measure public opinion about racism because when you ask people questions about racism, they lie. Yeah. Do you think black and white people are equal? Oh yes, oh yes, oh yes. I mean, everybody says this, but you know, it doesn't mean a lot. However, I think it's pretty clear that over the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s, more and more white people found themselves in a situation where black people were not only immigrants we see on the television, they were also, oh, they work in the same hospital. Oh, my doctor is black. Oh, yeah. And so there came slowly a physical social integration, which is not necessarily a result of government policy, but just accidentally, that it was possible to be, as a white person in Britain, it was much easier to be completely stupid about the question in the 1960s than 20 years later, because it's so mixed that, you know, Even the stupidest white people eventually say, "Oh well, now I've met 10 black people. Maybe they're not exactly what I thought." You know, they get a slow form of integration. Or also, especially children going to the same schools, you know, having the same boring exams. It's all very educational. Yeah, all very educational. Okay. So they get they have a few pictures for you. That's Stephen Lawrence. That's the Daily Mail headline. What eventually happened is that the Parliament changed the law to make it possible to have a second trial. And also technology advanced and they found some DNA on some of the clothes. And so they were able to, I think two of them are in prison and three of them are. I think one of them died and two of them are okay. Yeah, okay. So there's the actual McPherson report, 1999. So six years later, yeah. The Racial Agent Amendment Act 2000. And the next big event is 2003, the Employment Equality Religion or Belief Regulations in 2003. And this reflects, of course, the fact that the situation of multiculturalism changed tremendously after what has famously become known as 9/11. And it has to be said that in British English, we never did this, 9/11. It used to mean nothing in British English. We would used to say the 11th of September. But 9/11 has become British English since 2001. You were very young, yeah? But it was kind of shocking. It was kind of very shocking. And of course, this changed the situation about multiculturalism because it came to present, it came to allow people to present the problem, in inverted commas, as a problem of religion and not directly a problem of colour. And so there were more. There was more discrimination against Muslims after 2001, more attacks on mosques and so on, and I will be showing you some of that in a moment. But at the same time, the dynamic of anti-discrimination laws continued, and this led to this in 2003, the Employment Equality Religion or Belief Regulations. And this is something rather within Europe, rather specific to Britain. What does it say? Well, these regulations say that employers must make reasonable facilities available for the religious needs of their employees. So, for example, if you have a supermarket with 300 workers in it and five of them are observant Jews and they say, "We don't want to work on Saturday, please." The manager is obliged to say, "Okay, that's fine," because it's considered to be a religious need, and therefore, they're only obliged to make reasonable adaptations. So, another shop which has only three employees, in that case, if one of them is Jewish and doesn't want to work on Saturday. In that case, the employer can say, I only have three employees, it's impossible. Yeah, so it's only for bigger companies. Same thing, same supermarket, has 100 workers, and eight of them are Muslims and would like to have a room for praying in. The manager is obliged to say, okay, there's a little room for praying in. And again, same situation in a small shop, they're not obliged. So it's reasonable adaptations. This is why, for example, in all universities in Britain, there is a prayer room. I think you understand that the situation is a little different in France. Yeah, just a little. Maybe you should propose to have a prayer room and see what happens. So that an interesting new example. Another example, yeah, there have been observant Muslims working in supermarkets who said, I don't want to work in the alcohol department. And again, this was considered acceptable. Yeah, there have been some court cases about this. Again, this is 2003, it's 12 years now, but I haven't seen a detailed thing. But it's more, I think it's probably more a question of declared attitude, that probably the biggest distinction is whether or not the general population are considering religious needs in a different way because of this. Okay, that causes some controversy, of course. Another controversy, which is which I don't know an awful lot about, but which is sometimes seen in newspapers in Britain, is that in Britain you are allowed, in certain communities are allowed, if they wish, to have committees of their own community to solve disputes between two people. So, for example, in a Jewish community in London, there are Jewish rabbis who sit as a committee, and the two people who are in dispute come and discuss, and the rabbis decide. And in the same way, there are Muslim, they're sometimes referred to as Muslim courts, but it's probably an exaggeration, but there's certainly arbitration commissions. Now, this is a voluntary alternative, that is that any victim has the choice. They can go to this commission, or they can go to a standard tribunal. But these have been quite controversial recently, in particular because the word for law in Muslim circles, or laws for whatever subject, is of course the word Sharia, which is sometimes considered to be more melodramatic than it might be. Very, very often it's questions of inheritance, yeah, and things like that. Yeah, but there's been a certain amount of conviction about that. But nevertheless, there is something rather British about this, whereas the British state has generally said it's fine for different groups to have their consultant commissions and so on, that it's not considered to be a big problem. So here we are in one of the more controversial elements of multiculturalism, where, you know, where many different ways of doing things in the same society is considered to be okay. And the most recent date, the last date I want to look at, is the Equality Act 2010. Now, there are other things going on throughout the years 2000, and in particular in 2005, perhaps you remember, that's 10 years ago, maybe you don't remember, there was a big bomb attack in London. Yeah, well, I think there were 70 people died, 60, 70 people died, a series of bombs, and of course, very similar to what's happened a couple of weeks ago in Paris, really, in the sense that there was not a specific target, it was just anybody, you know, it's just a tube train, it's a horrible situation, and of course that also moved into the mix of relations between Islam and the rest of the population. Be that as it may, the Equality Act 2010 consolidated and united all the different laws against discrimination on basis of ethnic origin, sex and sexuality into one law. So the Race Relations Act of 1968, 1976 have all been abolished and replaced by this equality law, the Equality Act. Now, most of the contents of the older Race Relations Act are still in there, But it has been considered by some people that putting it all into one act was a way of, you know, not talking so much about racism anymore, and then it was a way of putting it onto the backstage. Certainly, it's fair to say that during the year 2000s, well, that there has been a rise of the far right in Britain in the year 2000, and of the last few years, and I have some examples of that in a moment. For example, the English Defence League has become more powerful in the last 10 years. And the English Defence League, which is not actually a fascist organisation as such, but is based on anti-immigrants and in particular anti-Muslim activity. So they will go and demonstrate, we don't want a mosque built here, you know, for example. I can't remember what the beginning of that sentence that sentence was. Yeah, but there's certainly been I think there's probably been a polarisation, in fact. So what you have is you have a rise of the far right's racist organisations, but also a rise of people who are radically opposed to them. So it's more a polarisation. It's not just a simple rise of racism. It's more a sort of polarisation. This is, of course, partly linked to the perception of terrorism, but also very much linked to the economic crisis. Yeah, of course, that when life is getting harder, people are always tempted to think it might be somebody's fault. Yeah, it's something going on there. So just to go through a couple of definitions, this is one definition which was given of multiculturalism. And I'm sure I've written who it is somewhere. I hope so. Multiculturalism in the modern world involves, on the one hand, the acceptance of a single culture and a single set of individual rights governing the public domain, and a variety of folk cultures in the private, domestic, and communal domains. Now, this definition is not a fact. This definition is one opinion. Yeah. Well, let's have a look at it. So, what one of the things that might be difficult about this definition is that the public domain is not very easy to define. Yeah. Now this, of course, comes up in France. I don't know if you know, for example, the 1948, I think, the Declaration of Human Rights, the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, says that showing your religion in public is a human right. That's the United Nations 1948. So the public domain, what is exactly the public domain? Yeah, is a school the public domain? That's the big question. Yes. And what is the difference between the public domain and communal domains? Some of these are difficult things to define. Yeah, we're not in an easy area there. But certainly there is a general belief that, you know, individual rights should be the same for everybody. You know, we don't expect people to have more rights if they're in one group than in another. And secondly, I think that multiculturalism might be a little bit more than this, because here we talk about acceptance, but I suspect that multiculturalism may be more than acceptance, but celebration. You know, that the idea of multiculturalism is that many cultures in a country is good, not just it's acceptable, but it's actually good. So that may be. And here you have the concept here of folk cultures. Des cultures populaires, something like that. Yeah, do you think so? Yeah, because they could have said. You see, the problem is in British, you have the both. They could have said popular cultures, and they said folk cultures. And there's something a little bit complex going on there. Yeah, like folk dancing. Yes. Okay. So anyway, that's one reasonable attempt at a definition. Oh, there you go. Good. This is John Rex. This is the opinion of John Rex. I will put this PowerPoint up on the blog. Yeah, don't try to write everything down. It's not necessary. John Rex. So this is a reasonable attempt. It's not perfect, but we won't get a perfect definition. But it's a reasonable attempt. This idea, if I would criticise it would be that word acceptance, because I get the feeling that multiculturalism is more positive than that. And here you have another opinion by Kenan Malik, an opinion about it. The idea of a plural or multicultural society is a deeply ambiguous one. The concept of multiculturalism overestimates the homogeneity and autonomy of the various ethnic groups and underestimates the degree to which all groups are reciprocally implicated in the creation of cultural forms within a common framework. Yes, and this is where you get, if you look at Britain and you look at a Muslim who lives in a small village in Wales and a Muslim who lives in London, you'll find that the Muslim who lives in London probably has a lot more in common with other people living in London than with the Muslim who lives in a small village in Wales. Yeah, because there are so many. This is a fairly common idea now that we have 10 or 12 identities at the same time. This is a problem from the point of view of public policy, because public policy is obliged to talk about groups. You can't talk about hundreds of different cultures. You just have to talk about big chunks to get through it. And today, so we're up in 2015 today, some responses to diversity questions, multiculturalism, racism today. Just a few examples here. So here is one example. This is an event, this year's event, 15th of August. Tickets £5, not very expensive. The Rise of the Black Pound. So this event is for businesses to discuss about how black businesses can encourage each other. Yeah. So if you're a black person who owns a small supermarket, how can you make sure that you specially try to buy from other black businesses? So this is a response to a perception of racism. Now the idea here, which you can agree or disagree, it doesn't matter. But the idea here is that because we are black businesses, we don't get treated equally, and so we have to privilege each other. Now this was very common, of course, in the United States. A very common idea, a black nationalist idea, where black people, you should buy in black shops because we need to help each other, because we can't rely on the wider culture to help us. So this is an event. Now, something you can notice about it is that we are talking about small businesses here. If you organise a business event and it costs £5 to get in, set to hall. Yeah, these are small businesses. Normally, if you go to a business meeting, you pay £100 to get in. Yeah, so this is something pretty small. But it's giving some ideas on that, and it gives this statistic: 36% of black people in Britain desire to start their own businesses. However, only 6% actually do it. Okay, so the suggestion is that this is that it's harder for black people to start businesses. But also the suggestion is that one of the solutions to racism is more black businesses. Very complicated and controversial question, because in fact there are a lot of black businesses, in particular where I come from in Lancashire, very often Pakistani small shops, Pakistani taxi drivers. Now, there are good reasons for this, good reasons in that, if you work very hard in a shop, you can make a living by opening 12 hours a day. The bad reasons for it is that, if it's very difficult to get a job because the companies are racist, you can be tempted to form your small business as a defense, just to make sure you have a job. So it's all a little bit ambiguous. A different, completely different area, completely different response to questions of racism, anti-racism today. This is a campaign against racism at football grounds. Now you're probably aware that sometimes in football grounds there is a very public and loud racism aimed at black footballers. There was a few famous examples recently with the disgusting racists throwing bananas at black footballers and things like that. Yeah. And this is an interesting campaign, because they're saying, let's not have anti-racism just on the internet or in political meetings. Let's go to the football grounds and give out leaflets and have discussion in front of the football grounds. So I think it's quite imaginative, really. It's always very tempting to, let's have a meeting on a Friday night, and of course everybody who comes to your meeting is already an anti-racist, so that's quite an ambitious and imaginative attempt, and has become quite popular. And here you have, for example, the Sheffield United Football Club, quite a famous football club, and they're all holding the Show Racism the Red Card placard. So various campaigns continuing. along those lines. And here is the music version. This is the later version of Rock Against Racism, was the 1970s. Of course, today, rock, if you talk to 15-year-olds, rock, what's that? Yeah. So so it was no longer possible to have Rock Against Racism. And so Love Music, Hate Racism is its latest version. And this is the October 2015, so this is up-to-date teaching here, October 2015 programme for the big big concert in Manchester. And look, all proceeds going to support refugees in Calais. So very, very modern, specific and concrete aims there. Thank you very much for listening. I look forward to next week hearing who's our stars for next week. Yep, 1, 2, 3. Great, wonderful. I look forward to listening to you. That's all for now. Have a good week. Yes, that's right.